Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Andy J Podcast.
Now, regular listeners to the show will know that, well, we often have a handful of your favourite celebrities, but every now and again, something a bit special happens, and we have a whole show with one superstar, and I'm elated to be able to say this week is one of those occasions. He's a comedian, an actor, an author, a writer, a broadcaster. He's just a man I'm so thrilled that we're going to get to know. It is the one and only Robert Webb. Robert, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Andy. Thank you for that introduction. I feel completely ravished by it. I don't think I've ever been called a superstar before. That was probably, I think I've just peaked. It's all just a slow decline from now on.
It's all downhill from here. Well,
oh yeah.
I mean, that I was told that just before I hit 40. So, you know, that's, you're slightly ahead of me in that. Have you discovered that? You're 48 now, aren't you?
I am indeed. Have I discovered that it's all downhill? Yes, it's a great question of managing a decline as gracefully as possible without, you know, too much shouting or crying. That's generally the idea.
It was, you know, from a pure fitness thing, and I know that you're massively into your fitness now. I'm not a fitness person at all, but I was doing that thing where I can remember, distinctly remember, someone saying to me, well, you know, when you train, it's easy in your 20s. Then in your 30s, it gets really tough. And then after 40, you might as well forget it because it's just so hard. And it's stayed with me, and it's obviously rung true because these prophecies tend to happen like that when you let them get to you, don't they?
Well, I wouldn't know about what it's like to train in your 20s or 30s because I didn't bother at all. It's really, it's even though what you just said is completely true, that I am quite interested in staying fit now. That's it just sounds so odd to me that, you know, that I'm a PE person now. Because I never used to be. From school onwards, you know, I was just not interested in running around, and I took a very aloof attitude to the whole thing. But I had a little bit of a hoo-ha with my health about a year and a half ago. I had to have a big operation on my heart, and since then, yes, I've been looking after myself a lot. I mean, really a lot better than before. So now I am someone who gets all dressed up in lycra. Not lycra, actually. I don't know what it's made of. It's probably polyester. God knows. What am I, a fitness clothes manufacturer? No. But I get all dressed up in something stretchy. And yeah, no, I run 3 or 4 times a week, and I do strength training and all kinds of stuff.
Is it the skin tight stuff, Robert?
It's not the skin tight stuff. Okay. Not well, at least not on the outside. It might be skin. The underwear may be skin tight. Who knows? I think it probably is. Yeah, but then it often can be that way. But the stuff on the outside is pretty baggy and leaves a lot to the imagination. if anybody is using their imagination, which they're not, because I'm 48, as we've said.
Is it, Robert, come on, level with me here. With the under stuff, the skin tight stuff, have you, because obviously you've mentioned you've been getting into fitness, right? So have you kind of noticed yourself in the mirror a couple of times and started to go, oh, form?
Well, I did that anyway, whether I was in shape or not. I'm definitely my own type. I've spent a lot of time looking at myself in the mirror. When I say skin tight, you know, I'm only talking about pants, which, you know, generally, you know, we don't, I suppose you do have non-skin tight pants. Yes, of course you do. Boxer shorts can still be very free-flowing, can't they? But yes, no, have I looked at myself in the mirror? Yes, of course I have. Of course I have. And, you know, see, I've got a visible left bicep for the first time in my life. Hey. Of course I'm delighted. So yeah, I don't know what else I do during the day, really. It's amazing I get stuff done.
Have you used that wonderful phrase, tickets to the gun show?
No, not in anger, not out loud, and not sincerely, and in fact not in any way. No, I haven't. But not even in my own head.
But now you have the noticeable left.
But now bicep. maybe I will.
It's, I mean, it's maybe
morning, darling. Tickets to the gun show.
It's in. It's on. I mean, I love it. You've got to, listen, if you've got it, flaunt it, even if it's just to yourself in the mirror.
Yeah. Yeah.
Robert, look, you've gone a lot earlier than I was expecting on the big operation. But let's chat, because I don't feel it's something we can go back to in like half an hour's time and go, hey, you mentioned earlier about your operation. I think we should talk about it now, because otherwise it would be weird to come back to it later. This was obviously a huge, huge thing in your life. It's one of those things when we look at our chapters of our lives, this will be one that stands out really significantly for you as a defining moment, a make or break moment, in fact, a live or die moment. I could dress it up in many more ways. I don't know how many more, but I don't need to. It was a huge, huge thing for you. And this came about because of a standard medical that was happening before you started filming back again.
That's right. Yeah, they do a sort of routine medical this is for the second series of Channel 4's Back, and normally this is a very sort of perfunctory affair. You sort of look over there and cough, and they get you out of the office as quickly as possible. It's just an insurance thing, and that's not to say that it isn't taken very, very seriously. But anyway, usually it's a very short medical. And anyway, the GP put his stethoscope on my heart and said, and pulled a bit of a worrying face, and then said, what have you been doing about the heart murmur? And I said, what heart murmur? And then after a few tests and CT scan and echocardiogram and whatnot, I had a cardiologist saying to me, well, you're not going to have a heart attack in the next fortnight, but if this isn't addressed in the next 2 or 4 or 6 months, this heart will fail. Which got my attention. So basically the problem was that it's a congenital thing. It's a birth defect. I had a prolapsed mitral valve, one of the valves in my heart that should be opening and closing and pushing blood around my body to do its thing, was just sort of jiggering around and not, you know, it had gone completely wonky. So 60% of the blood in one chamber was flowing backwards into another chamber. And the heart had grown and remodeled and changed into an extraordinary shape in order to keep the show on the road. And I had absolutely no idea. I mean, I didn't feel very well, but I thought that's what it feels like to be 47 and still not treating your body very well. I was still drinking heavily, smoking like a complete idiot. And just, I thought, okay, this is what I deserve because of my lifestyle. But it wasn't a lifestyle thing at all, although it probably didn't help. Anyway, so it's not something I can fix with pills. So I had open heart surgery. I was on the slab, not the slab. The slab's when you die. I was on the operating table, and I didn't, from which they did not transfer me to the slab, from which I woke up. So that's good news for me. For about, I don't know, 7 hours-ish. And then it was kind of 3 months recovery, really, before I went back to do the aforementioned filming of Back. Three and a half, four months. But it was it was quite a slow and long recovery, because it's a heck of a thing that they do to you on that table, because they're kind of, well, I won't go into details in case some listeners may be squeamish, but it's quite a big deal. So it takes a while to sort of get over it.
Yes, I've tried to picture this, Robert. Obviously I've been aware of your operation for a while, and I've been kind of imagining.
Well, I just won't stop. The reason is I won't stop banging on about it. My wife has heard that story so many times now. She's like, are you going to go on the radio and start banging on about your operation again? And she's mainly joking, but yes, it does come up. And yes. So I've got that story down to around 90 seconds now.
Well, I have visions of the surgeons and the anaesthetists and whatnot, sort of mid-op, just kind of taking selfies with you. You know, it's Jez from Peep Show. Come on. When are we going to get shows like this again, you know?
I did get told that by one of the cardiologists who's working in the hospital, that she heard from the surgeon that another surgeon said to him just as he was getting ready for the operation, because my surgeon hadn't particularly heard of me, doesn't watch TV very often, but another surgeon had said to him, I love this guy. If you kill him, I'm going to kill you.
Hey,
which
you
was
bought some
very
credit
nice
there.
To hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe he's got the selfie.
You need a fan in the right place. Yeah, no, it was, maybe he did. Yeah, he's in there with all the sort of gore and everything kind of exposed in his face there with a double thumbs up going, this is Jez from Peep Show's innards.
Brilliant. I wonder if he was giving you a monologue whilst it was happening so that he could, you know.
Who knows how these, I mean, you know, what kind of a person wants to become a surgeon anyway? I mean, they're not normal people. So, you know, who knows what he was doing?
What is normal, though, to be fair? You know,
indeed.
It's one of those difficult ones, isn't it? So, Rob, obviously, are you, because I've been thinking about this, obviously hearing that news ahead of the operation and so on, obviously it must have been like a ton of bricks crashing down on your head, etc. But are you a sort of hypochondriac? Are you a bit of an overthinker at these sort of things? Did your head go straight to, I'm going to die? Or were you a bit pragmatic about it?
It was the really dodgy moment was the sort of hour and a half gap in between hearing that something was really seriously wrong. And then I went for more tests. And then I came back and then hearing, this is exactly what's wrong. We know exactly what to do. We do this all the time. We're terribly good. We're posh surgeons and we're very arrogant and you're in very safe hands. But the bit where, you know, they're doing the echocardiogram and the technician calls the other doctor in and says, look at this. And you hear him saying, oh, blimey. You know, that was the scariest part of the whole thing, really. Probably scarier than the bit where just before the anesthetist, you know, you hear this gurgling sound in your neck as the anesthetic goes in. That's a bit scary. But the really scary bit was something seriously wrong. But before you hear that there's a plan. Once there's a plan, you kind of go, okay, this is completely out of my hands. There's not much I can do apart from, you know, just walk quietly around at home trying not to have a heart attack. And this will get sorted when it gets sorted. And so once there's a plan, I felt reasonably calm. I got described by a couple of doctors during this process as an anxious person, but it strikes me that you would be, wouldn't you? You would be a bit anxious. But I don't think of myself as an anxious person, but maybe I am. I don't know what I'm like. That's your job to find out, Andy.
Well, and thanks for letting me. Now, I would be incredibly anxious, Robert. How can you think of anything else? I'm sorry to kind of get so macabre, and I don't want to go macabre on you, but I'm curious because of the circumstances. Obviously, just so that our listeners know, you're a father, you're married, you've got two lovely young girls. Did you find yourself in those few days before the operation, knowing that you were going to operation and it was a massive one, did you find yourself sort of trying to install all kinds of life lessons into the girls and just telling them all kinds of extra important things?
No, because I thought that would worry them. I mean, when we told them, poor old Dorothea, who was eight at the time, the first thing she did, she burst into tears because she said, is this because I keep jumping out and making you jump? Because she was in the habit at the time of hiding behind the door and going, boo! And I said, no, darling, it's not because of that, sweetheart. But generally, the front that we wanted to put on, which was pretty much not that much of a front. It was kind of how I felt was, there's going to be this operation. It's very, very, very unlikely that anything's going to go wrong. And then daddy's going to be super tired and a bit useless for a few months. And then everything will be back to normal. So, I mean, on the quiet, we did, of course, I checked my will was in order. Abby, my wife, I gave her power of attorney and various power of, switching me off, whatever the phrase is. But I mean, there were certain practical things worth taking care of. And I emailed my friends, but I didn't say, you know, there was no kind of, I love you. You know, so you get, there's a 99% success rate for this operation. And it's only as low as that because most of the people who do it are quite a lot older than me. I wasn't that worried. I mean, obviously, irrationally, I mean, you can tell yourself that theoretically, but irrationally, of course I was scared. And of course, you know, you think I'm not going to wake up, or they're not going to be able to wake me up, or I'm going to wake up in the middle of the operation, or, you know, various things. You have all the usual worries. But no, as any parent will know, the point is to, 90% of parenting is distraction anyway. So you just have to, we had to pretend to be calm about it. And I think I was relatively calm, but obviously it was a big old do.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you've said, Robert, according to the doctors, you're actually very anxious. So you got that wrong. You weren't patient about it at all, my friend.
I should pull myself together.
Come on, get a grip. Yeah. It's only a massive heart operation, for crying out loud. what do you take us for? Robert, do you find it sort of, I guess bizarre is the word, that this was something that you had been living with? It's something that if it had been left as it was undetected, it would have killed you. Do you find it kind of slightly strange that you had previously just finished writing a story about someone who one of your characters had actually died from something because it hadn't been detected.
Yes. It's, I mean, on the other hand, it's kind of when you've been a writer for a while, you get sort of used to this weird relationship that you have with your imagination. And so basically, you know, the story of Come Again, my debut novel, is that we have Kate, our heroine. She's middle-aged and she just lost her husband, Luke. I won't do the whole plot of the book now. I will do the whole plot of the book at some point. But the point is Luke, dies from a brain tumor that's been undiagnosed for many, many years.
Yeah.
So while I was writing about this, middle-aged male who suddenly dies from an undiagnosed condition, I was a middle-aged male with an undiagnosed condition. Mm. So it doesn't seem all that strange to me that was my subconscious trying to tell me something. I just wish it had been a bit less subtle, but there it is. And I think, and there are other things in the book that come out like that. I think quite often a writer has a main character learning something that the writer is actually trying to tell themselves. But you don't really learn that until you finish the book. And even then, I didn't really look at it in those terms. You know, I don't go, I've written a work of light comic fiction. I wonder what I can learn from that. I just want people to read it. But yes, it's spooky, and at the same time, it's actually quite mundane. But of course, you know, my imagination it just comes. You know, our brains and bodies are not that separate, and my body was obviously in communication with my brain and saying there's something really seriously wrong, and that was at the back of my mind while I was writing. Clearly,
yes. Well, you use the word subconscious there, Robert, and I wonder, and I'm sorry if this sounds so twee, because I know you're a noted atheist. You know, it's, I believe you, you know, you...
Ooh, I wouldn't want to be a noted atheist. Well, they sound awful, but, but I'm not a person of faith, but I don't go around laughing at people who believe in God. But no, I'm trying to grow out of various things like that.
Sincere apologies for the phraseology. I obviously worded it wrrongly. I did not mean it.
That's right.
But you know what I mean, as in you're not an open church goer. We don't see on the gospel choirs and all the rest of it. We kind of touch on how you sort of found faith for a while when your mother died, which I'd like to circle back to shortly. But what I come back to the subconscious thing is, this is going to sound strange given that we've just mentioned religion and so on. But do you believe in guardian angels, for example? Because in a way, in Come Again, you know, there's the guardian angel feel to the wife, girlfriend, able to go back and tell her dead husband that he needs to save himself, for example. Similarly, you've written a book, you know, which has this underlying condition. Could that have been some sort of guardian angel figure trying to tap you on the shoulder going, oi, hang on?
No, I don't really. I mean, I see it as the way my body was trying to talk to me. I'll just briefly talk about, because the further we go without saying what's going on in Come Again, the more it might seem a bit mysterious. So Kate has lost her husband, and she's in terrible grief and she's not getting better. And in fact, she's become a danger to herself. And then one, they met, Kate and Luke met a long time ago in 1992, in their first week at university. One day, Kate wakes up, she's 18 years old, but she remembers everything. She's in her college room. This is the day that she met Luke for the first time. So she's traveled back in time for some reason, back to 1992. And she knows how Luke died. She thinks she's there to save him. She's going to try and do everything exactly the same, hence comedy. But he's not the middle-aged man that she lost. He is still the annoying 19-year-old English student that she first met. Hence more comedy, hopefully. So that's kind of that's where we sort of start with Come Again. The idea of her going back to trying to save Luke. I mean, yes, a guardian angel is one way of thinking about it. It's so much from Kate's point of view that she that it didn't really occur to me that she doesn't really think of herself as a savior or an angel. She's just trying to do what she thinks is the obvious thing to do, which is to warn Luke. But before she can do that, she has to try and get to know him, despite the fact that she knows literally everything about him. She knows him better than he knows himself, which is often the way with men and women anyway.
Men are just, well, yes, we're not as clever as women on any level, are we? They're just much better than us. End of story.
In some ways, yeah. I'd go along with that.
Yes. I'm so pleased that you have you have lightly surmised come again, because I didn't want to do it at all, because there's so much going on in this book. I sort of fear saying anything to spoil it, because it's got so many layers. It's a gripping, I mean, you know this, you've written it, you've heard enough people tell you, it's a terrific read. It's a really, really good
read. I haven't heard enough of this at all. You can carry on forever.
No, it's, I mean, it is, it's really, really great. I was wondering if, I mean, it feels like it should be a film.
Well, it's being adapted for TV.
Of course it is.
It hasn't been commissioned by a channel, but it got picked up by a production company who are terrific, called Firebird, and they found a brilliant writer, and she's written the first episode, and I sent my notes back on that last week for them to throw in the bin or to use as they wish. I'm just this sort of resource hovering in the background at the moment.
Would you be in it?
And they'll find a director and they'll pitch it to a channel. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, no, that would be very exciting. But I didn't want to write it as a TV thing or as a movie in the first place, because I think it's because coming out of the only other book I've written, which was my memoir, How Not to Be a Boy, I enjoyed that quite a lot. And I always wanted to write stories. I always wanted to, since I was a kid at school, in primary school, I used to, you know, my favorite subject was creative writing. And a couple of times I was asked to, you know, read my stories out to the school because they were funny, basically. And so, you know, that I was doing that before I was writing sketches. So it's always been an ambition to write stories. And so I wanted to do that in book form, because although working in television as an actor and a sketch writer, it has been brilliant fun and you get to work with lots of different talented people. It's nice to not collaborate. Sometimes it's also nice to do something on your own. And of course, by the time the book is a physical thing, I mean, turning that Word document into a thing that you can hold and read is a team effort. And there's a whole, you know, bunch of the editors and all the production people, marketing and all that stuff. But while it's just you and the story, you're the only person responsible for making this good. And you're your own boss. And if you want to spend 10 minutes worrying about this comma, then that's fine. And it's just a very, very different process from when you're collaborating with people for TV. So that's why I wanted to, it was always going to be, you know, in the form of a novel first. If it becomes anything else, then that's great. And they can take it away and rock and roll and do what they like with it and change it, whatever. That's all great. It'd be great. It's great to have, you know, another pair of eyes on it, another talent working on it. But in the first instance, I wanted to write my book on my own, and everyone else can go away. It's just me. I don't have to have David Mitchell agreeing with me that this is a funny joke. I know it's funny. Shut up, David. So it makes a nice change after the previous 20 years.
Yes, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Well, I mean, I'd be absolutely startled if it doesn't become a massive TV show, to be fair, because there's so much going on, and it's such a compelling story. It just keeps going, and it's a heck of a page turner. I mean, would you be in it if they made it into a TV show?
I seem to have forgotten to write myself a part. I mean, I don't think I'd be good casting for any of the main characters. I mean, there is a cab driver who gets his taxi stolen.
Yes, at one point I could be. Yeah.
Or there's the Malcolm, the barman in the college bar. Yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't mind turning up for just to pull a pint of Scrumpy Jack.
Or you could be on stage.
I could be one of the people on stage. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
that would be nice.
There's a bit of a showdown at the end of a really experimental and bad production of The Tempest. What is it? Oh, no, it's a musical.
Yes,
they've turned The Tempest into a musical. That's right. I could be one of the chorus.
That could be fun. Yeah. Yeah, again, I don't want to say anything about what happens in that scene because people need to read it because it's terrific. But yes, you've got to, oh, come on, you've got to, even if it's a cameo, you've got to be in it, clearly.
I think so, yeah.
Yes, How Not to Be a Boy, you've mentioned it, just really took the world by storm, didn't it? I mean, it was a Sunday Times bestseller. It's still, you know, being consumed by people in the tens of thousands, I imagine. It's an absolutely incredible read, and it's one of those stories you sort of say that it's full of humour and fun and laughter, but it also, I mean, I was crying my eyes out on many occasions. I'm sure you can understand where and when. You are very, very good at being so incredibly honest.
Well, thank you. I mean, thanks for all of that, Andy. But I mean, it's strange when people, when I was talking about the last book, 2017-ish, and people would say that it's honest or candid or brave or whatever. I felt a bit like, you know, Jim Hacker in Yes, Prime Minister, when Humphrey says, this is a very courageous course of action, Prime Minister. And Jim goes, oh, is it? Oh, really? Like, I kind of, really? Am I? Have I done something brave? I hope not. So I greeted that with this phrase with sort of alarm, really. I mean, I wanted it to be, there's no point writing a memoir if it's going to be just a PR exercise. Of course, it wants to be as honest as possible, but it's also, when it comes to other people, hopefully generous and outward looking book, not just because I don't want it to be sour and, you know, Scorsese-y kind of thing, but generous for the sake of being generous. And, you know, both the people who are no longer with us, like my parents, and indeed the people who are still around, who feature in it quite heavily as well. They all, you know, my wife and my brothers and sister and a couple of friends, they all saw early drafts and they got to comment on it. I mean, apart from with one exception, everybody came back with a double thumbs up. But Mark, my oldest brother, he thought I'd been a bit too rough on our dad. I mean, the thing is, Mark is 6, going on 7 years older than me. So it's funny, when you have siblings, I'm sure listeners will know this from families like this, or indeed their own families. You know, siblings who are a few years apart, it even though they come from nominally the same family, it feels, the dynamic is so different that they, you know, when they were 5, their parents might have been in a very different place to when, you know, their younger brother or sister was 5. You know, 5 or 6 years is long enough for a marriage to disintegrate, for example. Yes. So my experience of dad was kind of different from that of my 2 older brothers, which probably accounts for my taking a slightly different view. But you know, Mark said his piece and I met him halfway and I softened some of the language and I changed 1 or 2 bits, because at the end of the day, it's only a book. And he accepted that, and that was all good. But it's as honest as possible. I mean, most of the jokes are at my expense. I mean, me being a pretentious teenager and my being a, you know, as a child, a sort of countryside coward, and how I was scared of wasps and nettles and sport of any kind, and how I wasn't very good at being a boy, all because boys were supposed to be, you know, running and jumping and climbing trees and boisterous, and, you know, I was completely mute and very, very shy, and just it didn't feel that I could do this masculinity thing very well, and that has implications, I think. Well, I mean, one of the nicest things about the book coming out was that I got to hear from readers every day. One of the few good things about Twitter is that anyone can get in touch, and hearing from readers, especially male readers, to be honest, saying, this really rang a bell with me, and I didn't understand this masculinity stuff either, and I was just pretending. And that it's actually helped some people, which wasn't, you know, it was only sort of collateral benefit. I mean, I didn't do it because I want to be useful, but I, you know, it's nice to feel useful. It's a very rare experience for a comedian to feel useful, because that's not really the point of us. But it was a very nice feeling.
I think you shared a lot of people's childhoods. I think a lot of people could relate because of the way you explained it, and maybe not exactly the same thing, different circumstances and so on, but the inner monologue that you were experiencing, I suspect there were an awful lot of people out there, still are, who needed to read that, needed to hear it, because you never know, do you? I mean, everybody is trapped in their own heads, and unless you start sharing things, you've no idea if what you're experiencing is what everyone else is going through, or whether it's unique to you.
Yes, exactly, and I think partly because of the way boys especially are raised, the way we they're given the impression that they need to shut down their, you know, negative feelings, uncomfortable feelings. I think we're getting better at this, but certainly speaking for myself, in the 70s and 80s, I was definitely discouraged from sharing negative or uncomfortable feelings. It was kind of, you know, man up and close it down and switch it off like a light bulb, as they say in the Book of Mormon, which doesn't do you any good. It's just a bad idea generally, and I think that's possibly why men, especially, can be slow to ask for help when they're in trouble later on. Funnily enough, later this afternoon, I'm going to be recording an episode of Celeb Catchphrase, Say What You See. And my nominated charity is CALM, which is stands for the Campaign Against Living Miserably, and that's a mental health support group for men. It's a free, anonymous, confidential helpline and web chat service. And I think men can be slow to admit to problems like loneliness, depression, whatever it is, and CALM are there to fill that gap. So, and of course it happens to women too, but I think, you know, 75% of suicides in our country are male. And I don't think it's a coincidence. The way we talk to boys needs to change.
Yes, as a father of three young boys myself, I completely hear what you're saying. And it's certainly something that I have been very, very in tune with trying to do myself, you know, not expecting them to just automatically want to like football or superheroes, yeah, or whatever, you know, but quite the reverse, just seeing...
Although, of course, and I was, you know, keen to stress this now, not to be a boy, there's nothing wrong with liking football, and there's nothing wrong with preferring blue to pink or any of that stuff. It's just when it feels like an order, when it feels like, you know, this is how you do boy and there's no other way, that's when the trouble sets in. So, yeah, what I was trying to argue for, I suppose, was, I mean, in what is a very personal and subjective book and hopefully funny book, but if I was arguing for anything, it was for a sort of broader definition of how you go about being a boy and indeed how you go about being a girl.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's, and you argue it beautifully, and it's I think it's a read that should be on the syllabus. I think it's a read that everyone should have to experience, because it's a fantastic new view of the world that I think a lot of people, as I say, I'm completely aligned with the way you explain things and with the things you've gone through, and I really do feel that it's that important, actually, the way you set out your story. It's really powerful. Can we talk about some of the outline parts to your upbringing that you share that are a big feature that I think perhaps mold the person you are? Are you comfortable with that?
Sure,
because obviously
I'll be comfortable. I'll be comfortable until I'm uncomfortable, and then I'll let you know.
And then you let me know, and then I'll back away smoothly.
But I've written it all down in a book and published it, so it's not like much of it should come as too much of a shocking surprise.
No, but it was more that it's a surprise that it happened to you, Robert, if that makes sense. You know, the public perception of you prior to this book, I think, you know, was a very talented, very successful actor, you know, Cambridge, sort of cruised through life, aced it, you know, he's got the whole world at his feet, he's a good-looking guy, he's got, you know, got everything's going for him, it's all, you know, easy street. This is what the, you know, this is what the outside view is of people who are famous and successful. You know, everybody sort of just assumes they've had it easy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And actually, I'd say there's an additional feature to you as well, which is because of Peep Show, of course, as the character of Jez and so on. You, I think, brought to life that inner voice that nobody ever wants to sort of talk about and tell other people that they've got. But of course, we all have it. And seeing that on a massive show like Peep Show, it was suddenly like, oh, okay, so that's not just me hearing things. Everyone talks to themselves. Do you know what I mean? I think you took on this importance to people because you acknowledge something that we all do anyway.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I can't take any credit for writing Peep Show, of course. But,
but we associate you with it because you're one of the two lead characters.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, no, Peep Show had this this device where you hear what the main characters are thinking. So, yeah, I suppose it brings you into an especially sort of, this doesn't sound too poncy, intimate relationship with the audience, because you really are inside their heads. So yeah, I think that's partly why people grin at me in the street, is because they've heard me expressing all of Jeremy's darkest secrets. I mean, the funny thing is, when David and I came to at the end of a week of editing, when they were doing the edit of a series of Peep Show, towards the end, they'd get me and David to come in and record the voiceovers. And David would always have a couple of sides of A4, and I would have like half a side, because I think the difference between those characters is there's very little that Jeremy thinks that he doesn't just say, whereas all of Mark's stuff is internal. So it was always quite funny that, you know, I'd be out of there in 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Okay, so the things I wanted to talk to you about, obviously, one of the things that you raise very clearly, and you mentioned that, you know, Mark had a sort of challenge with how you described it, but nonetheless, you talk about the violence from your father as a child. You know, you were scared of him. And it's interesting. I've spoken to several people now who have had similar experiences to you, and I always find it just heartbreaking and startling. I can't even begin to put myself in that situation that you must have gone through. I must point out as well that your relationship with your father then improved immeasurably, and there was plenty of love there, etc. But nonetheless, those early memories, they must have been very haunting.
Yes, he, I mean, he was a scary presence. I mean, my mum and dad got divorced when I was five, but my those early memories of living in that house when dad was around, yeah, he was a scary guy. I mean, he wasn't doing anything out of the ordinary for someone of that time and place. You know, he went out, he was a woodsman, he cut down trees, literally, my dad was a lumberjack, and he'd go to the pub, he'd come home. He was, my memory of him was that he was short-tempered, that he used corporal punishment on his sons in the way that that was. I mean, you were allowed to do that at school, for crying out loud, yeah, until, you know, the early 80s. You would come at an eight-year-old with a stick, and that was not just not illegal. That was sort of best practice. So it was just a very different time and place. I'm only talking about, you know, slapping and spanking and thick ear. Nothing awful at all. But still stuff that if I imagine myself doing that to my children, it's just a completely different moral galaxy. They say that you sort of, when you become a parent, you forgive your parents. I think in some ways that's true. In some ways it's not true. In some ways you take an even dimmer view of what they were doing, than you did previously. But anyway, so that's how I felt about it. I say at one point, what is it? I shouldn't launch into sentences like I say at one point and then having forgotten what it was I say at one point. In the book, I say something like, hell hath no fury like an angry son with a book deal. But I'm not, but then I sort of immediately contradict that. You know, I'm not out to have a go at dad. I'm there to try and understand him. He was under, you know, a lot of pressure. And again, you know, he wasn't, it's not necessarily everyone's job to think outside of the box of their generation. You know, some people are just, you know, I'm sure I am in many ways, just going with the flow and doing what everybody else does. And so that was the setup, but it was, yes, I was scared of him. And then, you know, my mum remarried and we moved away. But then when she died, when I was 17, I went to live with dad again. Mm. And that made for an interesting time.
Yes, that took me by surprise when you said that you had done that in the book. I mean, it was lovely that actually there was the room for you to have that new relationship with your dad, with the one where you weren't scared of him and where you could say things. And obviously this furthers across your career, and there was all sorts of love that happened and all sorts of bridges that were built and so on further down the line. But yeah, when you said, you know, at age 17, you moved back in with him, I was surprised. I was like, crikey, okay. Was not expecting that.
No, I wasn't expecting that. There are loads of different sort of factors at play. I mean, mum died halfway through my lower sixth, and so I stayed living with my stepdad Derek and my little sister Annabeth, who was only about two at the time, for the rest of my sixth form until I got the grades. But I didn't get the grades that I needed because I was hell bent on going to Cambridge because of Cambridge Spotlights, and because, you know, loads of people that I love watching on TV, like Fryn Laurie and John Cleese and Clive Anderson, Clive James, and just Emma Thompson, just everybody, and it seemed that I really liked, have been through this student comedy club. The only trouble with that was that you needed quite good A-levels, and I didn't get anywhere near what I needed. And so I knew that I had to retake, and the idea of living with Derek and Annabeth for another for another few weeks was just, you know, I just couldn't do it. And also because, you know, that was the house that mum had lived in. And this turns up in Come Again, that when we first meet Kate, that she's lost Luke. And I think this happens when you lose someone that you live with, that place just becomes, it's like their absence is this presence. I mean, they're just everywhere in the sort of the squeak of the sofa and the hum of the fridge, and just everything reminds you of them. And just everywhere you turn. And I just didn't want to live in that house anymore. And dad was absolutely thrilled that I wanted to go and live with him. And also, I think there was a pull as well towards your surviving blood parent. I mean, I think that was a fairly natural thing that, you know, I just didn't know the guy at all. You know, he hadn't been a presence in my, you know, he was there for birthdays and Christmases and the odd fireworks night. And that was genuinely it. From 5 to 17. So I just wanted to know who this person was, apart from anything else. But it was a very emotional time and quite a very difficult decision. But that's what I did anyway.
Yes, yes. But of course, you know, grief does crazy things to us, doesn't it? You know.
Yeah.
we don't know who we are when we're hit with grief. Everything changes. It's and to go through it at 17 at such a crucial part in your life as well, because like you say, you had a singular focus, you know, which was get into Cambridge. You want to be part of Footlights. In a way,
I was kind of lucky that I had that as a kind of overriding, you know, plan. I was very focused on that, but in a weird kind of way, just because I was focused on it didn't mean that I was any good at doing it. Because I mean, you know, I thought I was going to retake in November, and I did absolutely nothing to make that happen. And I ended up going back to school for a year. I had what is euphemistically called a third year six when I was there. I was 19 years old. Because I was old for my year anyway, and I was putting on this school blazer and sitting in the class of the year below, and you know that planes a few edges off you. I was sort of you know, gagging on humble pie. So all that happened, but yes, I did have this overarching thing. I did make it happen eventually, but I had this thing to sort of keep me distracted, and I was young. I mean, it could have been worse. I mean, 17 is rough, but it could have been rougher. You know, I think it's hard if I had a friend who lost his dad when he was 8. I think that just seems incomparably worse to me. But anyway, there's always someone worse off. But it felt rough because 17 was, I was just sort of getting to know Mum as a kind of, we were just starting to have a sort of grown up relationship that I could talk to her about stuff. That was just at the very beginning of that, so that's why it felt particularly cruel. And as I say, Dad wasn't a big figure in my life, and neither was Derek, really, my stepdad. And so she was sort of my favorite person, so that's why it was tough. But you know, we get better. And again, in Come Again, you know, the sort of trajectory of the book, if you like, I mean, bearing in mind, this is a piece of light comic fiction and it ends with a car chase and a punch up, and you know, it's got lots of sort of fun things going on. But if it's to the extent it's about anything, it's about that movement from grief to mourning. Grief is, you know, is not meaningful. We don't learn anything. It just hurts. But eventually you move into a sort of later phase of this process that we call mourning, and that's where you start to reintegrate the lost past with the new present.
Yes.
It's where you start to see that the present actually has something to say for itself. And in Come Again, Kate literally has to go and live in the past in order to re-engage with the present. That's what Come Again is about, basically. But mainly it's lots of jokes and fighting.
Yes, there are lots of jokes and fighting. It is wonderful. When you talk about when your mum died, there's an expression you use. I'm not going to quote it exactly because that would be crude of me. But the essence is that there's a moment when you realise that actually you now need to go and achieve for her. You need to almost become a superhero to live for two people. And that sounds to me like that was a massive driving factor in you getting the grades you needed, taking the challenges of actually going, right, I will resit this ruddy year because I want to do this. I'm not just doing it for Robert anymore. I'm also doing it for Mum.
There was that sort of, I was sort of painting this, sort of telling this story for myself. I think one of the advantages of this happening when I was 17 is that teenagers can be, and in this case, definitely very romantic. And I was sort of romantically sort of seeing myself in this kind of heroic big screen kind of way. It's not just me, I'm doing this for, this one's for Mum. Which is very, you know, these, I would find that, to my ear, that's terribly sentimental and probably not, in the long run, probably wasn't a good idea that I saw myself in those terms, because you're just writing for a fall. But anyway, I think it probably was, not that I had any control over it, over how I felt or how I thought about this stuff, but at the time, that probably did help. Probably did help me. I mean, the trouble is, by the time you get what you want, and I did get to Cambridge, and if you've got this kind of self-heroic thing going on, the trouble is you might miss out on empathizing with other people. If you're wrapped up in this kind of, this terrible thing happened to me, oh, poor old me, and yet I risen from the ashes, blah, 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 and I managed to, you know, working class background, state school, went first person to go to university, it's Cambridge. Oh my God, I can't get over how marvelous I am. You're likely to be a bit of a dick if I can use that word on the radio. It's, you know, somebody's cat dies, you're going to struggle to have much sympathy for them. I remember this happening. Somebody was in tears because they're, of course, you know, this happens all the time. People get to university and that's exactly the time when the family pet dies.
Yes.
Or their parents get divorced. Yes. Or, you know, stuff that to me at that time seemed like small fry. But of course, you know, pain is relative. And if your mum hasn't died, if it's unthinkable that your mum would die, but Charlie the cat has just bought the farm, then of course that's an incredibly upsetting thing. It's not like I was laughing at people whose cat had died, but I really struggled to show enough kindness, anywhere near enough kindness. So this kind of, you know, it's me against the world thing, it's all very well, but I think it left me ill-equipped for love, really. It left me badly prepared for the world of human relationships.
Right. I mean, that changed, thankfully. You know, you're so yeah. self-aware, Robert. You know, just listening to you talk now, you know, you're sort of... Do you analyse yourself a lot, would you say?
I don't know, really. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I've had to think, I made myself think about that period of my life quite carefully because I was writing a book about it. But I don't constantly spend, you know, hours in introspection. I mean, I've been in therapy. I've been in and out of therapy all of my life. I think there have been two or three periods where that's been useful. So I suppose I've got the language and I've got, you know, the sort of the equipment to kind of think about things in a reasonably analytical way. But no, I don't. I mean, I don't know why I'm resisting this. Actually, I don't think it's necessarily a terrible thing to spend time thinking about your own feelings. But in fact, I think it's useful to be able to name them and to be aware of what's going on, and so that you don't end up, you know, your feelings don't become someone else's problem. I think it's good to be able to take responsibility for if I'm feeling afraid of something or ashamed or whatever it is, if I'm not careful, that might come out as anger directed at other, you know, innocent bystanders. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to try and keep an eye on your own, to be your own emotional detective, to work out why am I feeling what I'm feeling at this moment? And, oh, it's because of that. And I think that's probably quite a useful thing, but it doesn't do somehow to talk about that, does it? I mean, for some reason, I can feel myself kind of going, no, I don't spend hours thinking about myself because it feels selfish and it feels self-indulgent. And that's a terrible thing to accuse someone of. But there again, I think that a certain level of that is probably useful.
There's a shift in the psyche these days though, Robert. You know, people are now encouraged to think more about themselves, to put themselves first, to talk about their feelings, to take days from work if they're just not feeling right, not because they've got a headache, but just because for some reason they've woken up a bit glum and so on. You know, that is becoming much more recognised and much more acknowledged and rightly so, I think.
I think there's a balance to be struck, isn't there? I mean, there's still a part of me, you know, with my upbringing that wants to go, look, sometimes you've got to do the thing that needs doing, even if you don't feel like doing it. Right. But there's a distinction between that and, for God's sake, pull yourself together. I mean, yeah, you sort of have to do it on a case by case basis, don't you? I mean, I feel myself kind of rebelling against any kind of, if you're just feeling a little bit down, then it's okay to, I mean, the way you, I'm sure you didn't mean to put it quite like this, but you didn't put it like this. This is a caricature, but if, you know, I'm feeling a little bit headachy, I must be allowed my me time. You know, of course it does. It can tip over into self-indulgence and into just being lazy, but you know, the rest of the time, some of the time something really bad is going on or something really important is going on and you need to cut yourself some slack. Thinking about yourself is not necessarily putting yourself first. It's being able to identify what the problem is doesn't necessarily mean you're only concerned about your own problems, because sometimes you'll be in a position to help other people if you know what's going on with you. And if you don't know what's going on with you, you might cause problems for other people. So it's not an entirely self-centered thing. I think, you know, good mental health benefits everybody. You've got more time to look outwards and to be generous and to be, you know, kindness. And kindness is the name of the game, really. It's the silver bullet. It's the answer to pretty much everything.
Yes, I think you've explained that brilliantly, Robert. And you're right. You know, I completely appreciate what you're saying about the balance. And if I misworded the question, then my apologies.
No, you didn't. You didn't. That was just me. It was just like, you know, ancient conditioning going, must not be self-indulgent, must not be self-indulgent. So, you know, I don't want people to think I'm, you know, some woke, lazy, awful man. That's the voice in my head sometimes.
Do you care what people think, Robert?
Yeah. I wish I didn't, but I think I probably do. I've found myself withdrawing from, in fact, almost completely withdrawing from social media these days because it's just not worth the aggro. And I, when I was writing, there was a time sort of 2013, 15, 16, around the middle of that decade when I was writing lots of columns for the New Statesman and stuff, getting very involved in politics and having very opinionated views on Twitter about the Labour Party and whatnot. That was a really bad time for me. I don't know why I felt the need to do that. I felt some weird responsibility to do that. And I wish I sort of hadn't really, because at heart, I'm not a campaigner and I'm not a journalist. I'm not, I don't like debating. I'm a lousy debater. People were asking me to go on BBC Question Time, and I turned that down like four times. And I thought, I can't think of anything more nightmarish, because, you know, the moment somebody disagrees with me, I'm going to completely go, yeah, you're absolutely right. And then just, you know, I thought any edition of that program would just end up with me crying or shouting. I am at heart, you know, an actor. I want people to like me. I mean, it's not, you know, that's why we do it. I mean, people, sometimes you listen to actors and they go, yeah, fame is, it has its uses, but that's not really the point. The point is, you know, I just want to do good work. You know, it's absolutely nonsense. Of course you're interested in being famous. You wanted the attention. You know, all actors and comedians, in my view, with something or other happened in their childhood or the circumstances were such that they have a kind of personality where they want the unearned love of strangers. They want people that they will never meet to approve of them. And that's as true of me as anyone. So, I can't help thinking of it as a character flaw, but maybe it's not that, it's not so terrible. But yeah, I do, I think I do want people to like me, yeah.
Do you like yourself? That's a horrible question. I feel grim for answering.
It's a horribly good question. I think I'm all right. In so far as, you know, I don't have any serious mental health problems, which is almost the definition of not liking yourself. I think I must think I'm all right. I mean, I reserve the right to change my mind about me. but you know, I hope I have a reasonably realistic view of, you know, my flaws and strengths and whatever. I think, you know, most people are just farty humans trying to do the right thing. I would put myself in that vast, vast category of humanity.
Well, and you have the newfound tickets to the gun show, Robert. So, I mean, you know.
Indeed. I should be kissing my pecs. Can you kiss your pecs? They'd have to be quite big, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Yes, it's the gums that you kiss, isn't it?
Yes,
right.
Unless you've got incredibly long, malleable lips, then it's possible.
Yes, massive Jagger lips. Yeah.
Even he would struggle, I suspect.
But surely.
Who knows? I mean, I'd pay to see it if it could be done. I mean, that would be exciting. What does happiness mean to you, Robert? While we're sort of on this slightly morose question of do we like ourselves and so on, which I always find a bit weird asking people, but it's also quite important to check in, I think. What is happy to you, and is it something that you are or you seek or you have or what?
I'm not sure if I go around actively chasing happiness, because I don't know if that's, I don't know if how sensible that is. I think happiness happens when you're not looking for it. I think when you're engrossed in doing something. For me, I suppose, you know, if I'm sitting out in the sunshine reading a book, those can be really lovely moments, or, you know, moments with family, or when I make my children laugh, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, I don't really, you know, excuse me, it just kind of creeps up on you when you're not. I think happiness is this thing that creeps up on you when you're not expecting it, and you don't really notice it at the time. But sometimes, I mean, Peep Show is great for that kind of, you quite often, more than once, I think you heard both Mark and Jeremy saying in their own heads, this is it. This is me having a good time. I'm having a good time.
Yes.
And it's very, I don't know if it's my generation in particular or just everyone who, that we watch ourselves, that there's this self-consciousness about, you know, if you, the moment you notice that you're happy, is the beginning of the end for that moment of happiness, because you're conscious of it. And that changes it, I guess, doesn't it? So I think happiness is something that you look back on. But there are times when you're out dancing or whatever, and you know that you're having a good time, and you're laughing because you're having a good time. I've had that experience every now and again. Well, every now and again, 20, 30 years ago. But actively pursuing it, I don't know. I think pursuing meaning, trying to find stuff that fulfills you, that's a reasonable way to spend a life, I guess. And happiness will sort of come as a byproduct of that, whether it's with relationships or, or, you know, your hobbies or your work or whatever it is, you know, finding some kind of meaning to life, finding some kind of something that fulfills you, something that fills you up, something that feels nutritious, if you like, is sort of separate from happiness. But I think happiness might come out of that. I suppose that's how I mean, it's not like I spring out of bed every morning and go, I must find some meaning and fulfillment, for God's sake. You know, I just stumble out like most people, not knowing what on earth's going on and not having that much control over what happens during the day. And like I say, just bumbling along like a farty human, trying not to cause too much harm. But if there's a thing to do, I guess it's to try and fill yourself up with something that means something to you.
You're, if that makes any sense. Yes, you're one of us, Robert. You know, you do what makes you happy, and you know what makes. I mean, you know, for example, if someone phones you and says, "Hey, Robert, listen, this is what we'd love you to do today," in your head, you can immediately assess the level of fun that is going to equate to, can't you?
Can I?
Yeah.
Well, I can certainly assess that. I think I've come from a lazier point of view, that I can assess how much of a shag that's going to be to have to do that thing. Do I really have to? Okay, I'll do that then. Remember, just because I'm exercised doesn't mean I'm not 48 and I'm fairly tired in my head, kind of going, if I can get away with not doing stuff, I usually will.
But for example, you know, you've mentioned what you're doing this afternoon, and there must be part of you that goes, do you know what? I'm going to say I'll have a pee, please, Bob, and I'm going to laugh. You know, this...
It's catchphrase. It's not blockbusters, let's get our catchphrases right.
I've got it so wrong. Catchphrase is the lesser sister of the
I don't know which sort of TV version of me is going to turn up, whether I'm just going to be very bouncy and enthusiastic or just very, I think I'll just let the general fear, because I am very afraid of that I'm going to raise no money for this charity, because I'm not actually very good at catchphrase. My children are much better, but they weren't in Peep Show, the idiots. So they haven't been asked. I think I'll just let the nerves do the talking.
Oh, it'll be great. Well, you could always ask to do two versions of it, like you do with Back, you know, and you could have the sort of charming, delightful Robert and the utterly terrifying, potentially very hostile Robert, and see which one, you know, which one does best.
Yeah, I mean, that would be easier, you know, if I didn't have to be me. That would be, if I was just playing the character of this so-called celeb who turns up, and it would be great to play a part. That's a lot of what actors are interested in. They get to hide their own selves, hide behind this other character. That would be great. But no, I'm saddled with me this afternoon. So who knows how that'll go.
Oh, I hope it's a huge success, and I hope you make an absolute packet. Robert, you know, there was so much I thought we were going to talk about, and talk about in quite a lot of detail, such as Back, such as Peep Show, such as what's coming next, and so on. And yet we've gone down this lovely alley of feelings and personalities and so on, and I really do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andy. That was a really enjoyable chat.
If you're enjoying the Andy J podcast, we'd love a review. In fact, if you're enjoying the show, why not tell your friends? Podcasts live and die on, well, often word of mouth, so please tell your friends. Like, subscribe, review, and share. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.